Welcome to Series 2, Episode 9 of The Thought Exchange. This episode is a conversation with Matt Shirley, a conservation scientist with a particular passion for and interest in crocodiles. I met Matt on a shoot where he was the animal expert and I was brought in to deal with some pretty challenging technical problems in order to capture crocodile behaviour which had not only never been filmed but had never even been observed in the wild before. Unfortunately, I can't say any more as we are signed up to an NDA. So anyway, I got to know Matt on a long journey into the jungle of Gabon. It took us 11 days to go from Libreville, the capital, to the point where we could actually record on camera. Matt's expertise and knowledge of the local conditions and people were formidable. A childhood passion for reptiles led him to work with crocodiles, but Matt also works on pangolins and forest-dwelling tortoises, primarily in the forests of West Africa. His research has led to the recognition of 3 new crocodile species. However, it is his work as a conservation scientist which I found most fascinating. The work he has done and the conclusions he has drawn might be uncomfortable for Western observers who passionately want to protect and save all individuals from under pressure species. Yet, for anyone who has spent time and worked in those challenged ecosystems and has been confronted by the poverty of the people trying to survive within or alongside them, it is hard not to see the sense in positions that advocate meaningful management rather than preservation at all costs. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. So hi Matt, good to talk to you.
Thanks Piers, it's lovely to be here.
So we've been stuck in sweaty Gabon, not allowed to talk specifically about the project we're doing, confidentiality reasons, but it's about crocodiles. And you've spent quite a lot of time in Gabon over the years. So has this been a sort of central point of your study, or is it West Africa generally that you've been working in?
No, for sure. I mean, between West and Central Africa, I've been working in the region since 2002, 2003. And so between are periods when I focus more on Central Africa, periods when I focus more on West Africa. But Gabon was certainly a central location for a big portion of my PhD.
Yeah.
I spent about 6 years here.
It's quite a tricky environment to work on. Working in terms of the, you know, we've been hammered by flies, tsetse flies, you know, it's the humidity is unbelievable, you know, heat, just living in the bush itself is draining. So I mean, how much of that sort of stuff have you, are you in the field in the forest all the time, or do you work with scientific centers based out here? How does it sort of pan out?
No, most of the time, this has been one of the more challenging parts of my job is when you focus on species like crocodiles, which aren't really on the top of the conservation or science agendas for most institutions, you're kind of always lone rangering it a bit. And so I'm always way out in the middle of nowhere. And even when I have other people with me, you know, I end up being the only person that actually brings the crocodilian expertise. And so it's a lot of training and capacity building with people who aren't quite familiar with the approaches and way to go. And so... But yeah, no, we spend a lot of time out in the wetlands of Gabon, like the forested wetlands in particular, with just, yeah, the flies are bad, the mosquitoes are worse. And
and you've had malaria a couple of times on the back of that.
I think I'm going on 20 now.
20 times you've had malaria?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, and you've never gone cerebral, you've always...
Well, you know, it's always, well not always, it's most of the time the particular parasite that causes cerebral malaria, but you know, if you catch it in time and you are diligent about treating it, it doesn't really get that bad.
Right, so malaria is just basically part of the background noise of doing your job.
Yeah.
Well, what's your job title then? Because I know you don't just do crocodiles, but you've also got projects with pangolins as well.
Yeah. So I guess the most general way to describe me is a conservation scientist.
Right.
What I do is I focus on species. So I'm like a species ecologist or a species conservation scientist. And so what does that mean? You know, we spend a lot of time better understanding the species themselves. And sometimes this has to do with their evolutionary trajectory. Mm. And on that note, for example, you know, up until a few years ago, we thought that there were only 3 species of crocodile in Africa. We now recognize 7. And a lot of that has to do with my work. And then I do a lot of work that has to do with species-environment interactions, and in particular, how does the human landscape impact like the norm, what we'd expect species to be normally doing in their environment. So, you know, if you take a crocodile in the middle of a national park, and then you take that same species in an area that's more degraded, has, you know, villages and agricultural plantations and stuff, does that impact or influence of human activity change what they're doing? And then how do we have to adapt our conservation approaches to it?
So in a sense, your expertise is in crocodiles, but you're using that expertise to actually look at conservation. So you're using your expert metric is, I know crocodiles and how they should behave and what environments they look at, and then you use that specialist knowledge to kind of go, how's that changing as the environment changes? Is that fair?
Kind of. You know, I think this day I'm expanding a bit more beyond crocodiles. I use a project on pangolins now and other species. So I guess I would say my expertise is really in species and understanding individual animals, and then kind of gauging how the different influences, whether that be, you know, habitat change, hunting, poaching, deforestation, whatever it is, might impact species. And then because we at some point in time we have to acknowledge that we're living in a world with continually degrading landscapes and obviously continually increasing demands of humans on the landscape, you know, how do we then manage species under these continually dynamic environments or increasingly dynamic environments, I guess?
Yeah, because the management goals change as the environment changes, exactly. Because you no longer have the same habitats to put them in or right. manage them within.
Yeah.
So in terms of sort of the general picture of crocodiles, you said there were three and now there's seven. I think, is it 25 species globally of crocodilians or?
So right now we're at 27, 28, depending on the latest publications. And there's a few in the works that might increase that a few more. I don't think we're ever going to go so high as 40 or 50, but we're going to end up somewhere between 28 and 35, if I had to guess.
And so what's causing this adding of species? Is it just more exploration, more exposure to their environments? Is it better genetics? Is it how are we defining those new species?
It's a bit of all of the above. You know, crocodiles have always been among the more visible, let's say, species on the planet. And so if you look back to these 19th and 18th century natural history expeditions and stuff, crocodiles always got taken and collected and put in museums. And so as part of that, most crocodile species were described very early on. And not just the species we recognize today, but people were recognizing, let's say, a variation. You know, they saw a slightly more yellow one or slightly more spotted one of a pretty widely distributed species. And they'd recognize that or describe that as a species based on these very kind of like amorphous, which is a kind of funny word, amorphous morphological criteria. It's like, you know, I see something that looks a bit different, therefore it is. And then, you know, as time has gone on and scientific technology, especially for genetics, has kind of expanded, and we've been able to better understand kind of expectations for gene flow in the landscape and what a lack of gene flow or disrupted gene flow over certain periods of time might do to species, and then how that relates to morphology in particular, for example, it's enabled us to better understand that these things that ostensibly look very similar are not. Because they're totally isolated from each other. Meanwhile, these other things that sometimes look a bit more different aren't actually that different because they have continuous gene flow. And that's all kind of, you know, that's all facilitated by the landscape. And so what's fascinating about Africa is if you look at Africa as a continent, right? Or let's say you look at just the parts of Africa that crocodilians are distributed in. A priori, it makes no sense to imagine that all of these populations are connected to each other through gene flow, even if it's a stepping stone gene flow, right?
So when we're talking about gene flow, you're saying there might be two species that are recognizably similar, but there's no connection between them physically, so therefore the genes in one community are separate from the genes in another. So they're sort of isolated communities of what was originally the same species.
Exactly. If you go back far enough, almost everything comes from the same progenitor species, right? This is kind of how evolution works. But yeah, so for crocodiles, you've summed it up very well. And so basically what you have is two populations of crocodiles that maybe, let's say, are on the east and west side of a mountain range or on the north and south side of a desert or what, like totally inhospitable habitat for crocodiles. And over the course of hundreds to thousands of generations, if they do not have individuals that are continually reproducing successfully and homogenizing the genetic diversity, or, you know, making it the same between those two groups, eventually they become two different species.
Even if on the surface of it, they look, they still look the same because the environments that they're both living in are functionally the same.
Exactly.
They become distinct because of the genetics of it.
Yeah.
But presumably, I mean, one of the definitions of species always used to be whether or not they can interbreed.
Mm.
So does that genetic sort of separation in those communities mean that those communities can't breed, or are they still able to breed?
So oftentimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
And so, you know, this whole thing, biological species, the two things are not the same species if they can't mate and reproduce and produce a fertile offspring. I mean, it's a wonderful concept in theory, but of course, how do you ever test a natural environment, right? If you don't, let's say you have two groups of animals that are just separated by distance, they would never have a chance to come into contact. And so even if they could,
well, unless you manufacture it,
right?
Yeah, unless you manufacture that opportunity.
Exactly.
in basically, you know, non-wild settings.
Right. So that happens a lot with crocodilians, actually. So you get these instances of crocodile farms, like commercial production facilities, and they have two different species, and then somebody has the brilliant idea to hybridize them. And then if they happen to have the complementary chromosome numbers, then they actually can usually reproduce successfully. But we're talking, you know, like the Cuban crocodile and the Siamese crocodile, two species that would have never come into contact historically and are as far as distantly related as two species in the same genus can be.
And they're doing that presumably for commercial reasons, like, the patterning on the Siamese crocodile is great, but the toughness on the other one's good.
And then you get stuff like hybrid vigor, where the animals get bigger, they grow faster, so you can get higher productivity, that sort of stuff. But so then it's really funny, if you go back and you look at, let's take the Nile crocodiles, for example. We now recognize two species of Nile crocodile in Africa. One's called the West African crocodile. It's got a really kind of cool distribution, mostly in West Africa. And
so that's no
longer called the Nile crocodile. It's called Crocodilus succus.
So is this what we're talking about, one of the new sort of species?
Exactly.
Where it was generically described as a Nile crocodile because it looks exactly the same as a Nile crocodile.
Exactly.
But actually, it's not connected to the Nile crocodile's main distribution.
Right. And so when we went in and we started looking at this further, we recognized, okay, well, there's all these weird populations of Nile crocodiles. So like historical literature, you know, these like early 19th and 20th century colonial game wardens who are like, oh, there's these really weird tiny little Nile crocodiles in this one part of the country in this river that has no connection to this other part of the country. And then you have crocodiles in West Africa, for example, that, you know, even though they get somewhat big, you never had the same incident rate of attack as you do Nile crocodiles. And so people always thought they were much more docile, and then, you know, they're a little bit uglier and a little bit smaller and weirder and these sorts of things. And then so we went around and we sampled all these populations and we figured out, okay, well, there's actually two species. And the fun part is they're not even sister species.
Right.
So the Nile crocodiles, it turns out the real Nile crocodiles, the ones we still recognize today as Nile crocodiles.
In the Nile? I mean,
they're all East Africa, South Africa.
Right.
They're actually the sister species to all of the New World crocodiles, the American crocodile, the Cuban crocodile, that sort of stuff. And then the West African crocodile is, let's say, the sister species to the most recent common ancestor of that other group of species, right?
Right.
So it's like a sister clade relationship.
So they sort of split at some point.
They split at some much more distant part.
And they've just stayed morphologically similar because the environment suits.
Because the environment's the same and all that stuff.
So they haven't needed to change.
Right. You know, and of course there are very subtle differences morphologically. Like I've seen hundreds of both species and I'm like pretty good at saying this is that, and then we confirm it genetically and it is most of the time. But what's really fascinating about this, in addition to that, is their chromosome numbers are different. Now crocodiles have 32 chromosomes. We've known that for a very long time, 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
West African crocodiles have 34 chromosomes.
Right.
And so where this is really cool is there's been some collections, the zoological collections in the US and Europe, for example, that didn't recognize the two species, thought they were all Nile crocodiles, had them in the same enclosures, and they never hybridized. And even if they had tried, you would end up with a mismatched chromosome number, 34 and 32, the average.
So that would explain, so they've got them in captured settings, in zoo settings, and they've got two animals that they think are the same species, and then they're mystified because they're like, these things aren't breeding.
Right.
Turns out they can't because they're actually genetically distinct in terms of their chromosomes.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating.
And then, you know, so let's take another African croc example, the slender center crocodiles. This is like my baby. The slender center crocodiles are like the ones that I've contributed the most knowledge to. And, you know, historically we thought it was one wide ranging species from basically Senegal to Lake Tanganyika. And then we went and figured out that the ones in Central Africa are different than the ones in West Africa. And there's some morphological differences. They're very subtle and whatever, but genetically they're totally different. Mm. And then this is a really fun story. It turns out that up until 2013, the oldest crocodilians in captivity anywhere in the world was actually a pair of slender-sided crocodiles. They were in the, if I remember correctly, it was the Lausanne Zoo in Switzerland. And these crocodiles are fascinating for two reasons. They were given to the Lausanne Zoo, as like 1920 plus or minus, right, by the famous American jazz singer Josephine Baker. Why in God's name Josephine Baker had two slender-sided crocodiles that she gifted to Lausanne is unknown. But so they survived World War I, they survived World War II. They were, as a male and a female, they were kept together since the
1920s. And they never bred.
We ran genetics on them. It turns out one was from West Africa and one was from Central Africa.
So even though to zookeepers in the 1920s right through to fairly recently, people looked at these two crocs and thought they're the same species.
Yeah.
Actually, they're not.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's really fascinating. I mean, is there something in that to do with the fact that these are such an ancient species? I mean, there's very few other species on the planet that have, what, a 200 million year lineage, and they've survived two major extinction events, right? The one that wiped out the dinosaurs and a previous extinction event 201 million years ago. So, I mean, they're more than 200 million years old as a family, right?
Yeah.
So, is the fact that they're so... It's almost like the slug. I look at a slug and it's like, it's just they've not really changed. You get slugs, you know, millions and millions of years ago because they fit their niche and they're perfectly happy in it. So is that why you might get two species that are very similar, but, you know, actually different species, because they don't need to change. They're sort of in their environmental niche and they're sort of perfectly suited to that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think in some ways that puts a lot of assumption on every environmental difference results in a morphological difference and all those sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, generally speaking, I think you kind of captured it well. You know, even if the crocodilians that we recognize today come from a much older lineage. So modern crocodilians, we say, are only like 100 to 150 million years old. I'm not up to the exact paleontological science right now, but it's like 100 to 150 million years old. Mm. But then they come from a lineage of crocodiliforms, which are all very similar looking externally, like groups of animals that date back to, you know, 200 to 300 million years. But, you know, and one thing that people have always loved to say is, you know, these things are like living dinosaurs because they haven't changed. Well, it's not strictly true, right? Because, I mean, if we look at evolutionary change, what's the definition? So you can do it on, like, basically shifting frequencies in genetic composition, right? And that happens from a generation-to-generation basis. But, you know, you do end up with this huge environmental pressure, environmental constraints on change. And if you've had even 100, 150 million years to kind of evolve as the perfect kind of machine in response to the environment in which you live, then yeah, you're not going to get these gross changes, right? And no matter what, especially not in the short time frames that we're talking about, that speciation is happening today relative to the length of time the lineage has existed, right?
Right, but I mean, if you know, there's a fantastic podcast by BBC, the history of our time, which is with Melvin Bragg, and they look at the sort of ancient history and evolution of crocodilians. And I mean, it's quite extraordinary the extent to which, you know, such a relatively large animal, because we think of, say, for instance, take the dinosaur extinction, the animals that survived were pretty small, had a pretty small footprint. But crocodiles survive because they have this metabolism and this system, and they're also, you know, the species that particularly survived are linked, I believe, to fresh water. You know, so there's something in there that they were already like kind of perfectly adaptive to find that little path through this event, which took out, you know, 95% of all life at the time. Yeah, so
it's impressive.
But what are the specific adaptations and the specific sort of environmental niche to adaptations that they were using to survive that event? Do you know?
Like, you know, it kind of depends on the species, for example. So some species take Cuban crocodiles, for example. Mm. Cuban crocodiles have been around for a relatively long time, several million years. But if you look back to an environmentally more favorable time, both climatically, so it's maybe warmer environments with a lot more fresh water around, and more abundant mammalian prey, for example, Cuban crocodiles were much bigger at some point in time than they are today. And so that's one of the other really cool things about crocodilians is they're highly adaptable, and they can kind of change with the times and with the environmental constraints. Mm-hmm. And so if you're, let's say you're in a global cooling period where the water levels decrease and the forest cover kind of retracts and the resources are less abundant, and let's say you don't have as much energy to dedicate to very large clutch sizes and things, you know, nests, like numbers of eggs, those sorts of things, then if you can kind of just reduce your body size to get on with whatever resources are there, produce smaller clutches and groups of eggs for a while, and then, you know, maybe 100, 150 generations later, the environment changes, and then you can kind of, you retain that capacity to grow back out and succeed again under a different set of environmental conditions.
And is that partly because of the way they work metabolically and they grow? Because they get to a certain size, but they kind of have very long lives, right, relative to a lot of animals.
Yeah.
So is that, I mean, what are we talking about there? What's the life length? And Is that sort of ability to change sizes also part of their ability to just be around for a long time?
I don't know that it's necessarily the ability to be around for a long time, because then you'd have individuals adapted to one environment kind of bleeding into the next environment. Mm-hmm. Those individuals may not be as successful in that new environment, right? Sorry, I totally blanked on the first part of your question.
No, I'm just wondering with you're saying they're very adaptable, and one of these adaptations, like less food, you go smaller, but they're still retaining the ability to grow bigger. So is that linked to the way their metabolism works and how they grow, you know, as because obviously everyone thinks they're cold-blooded, you know, so is there something to do with the system that they're using metabolically?
Presumably, you know, you can imagine that if an animal is cold-blooded, meaning, you know, it gets its body temperature from the environment itself, if you're in a cooling period where you're just not getting access to as much heat, it means you have less capacity to metabolize more energy. Mm. If you have less capacity to metabolize more energy, you have less capacity to grow bigger, less capacity to reproduce bigger clutches. But that doesn't mean it's going to kill you, right? Yeah. So you can have like thresholds where below which or above which you just cannot survive. Mm. But within that, you can imagine very easily a fair amount of adaptability, where you're in a much like a period for generations at the lower end, you just kind of adapt to it. Period for generations at the higher end, you adapt to it.
So there's a suggestion there that you almost don't need to, you don't need this model of like, oh, well, the environment's changed, and therefore you need generations and generations and generations for that animal to adapt to being smaller. It's got the potential to stay smaller, it's got the potential to grow big according to what resources it can get. So
it's always going to take generations, though, right? To at least see the population level shifts.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's sort of locked into their metabolic system, so there's more likelihood that smaller ones will survive. Yeah, because I did a program, we went to the Arctic, and we looked at the ancient forests of 50 million years ago in the Arctic. So it's still 6 months of light and 6 months of dark, right? It's still, but it's a lot warmer than it is now. Obviously, there's no ice there, but crocodiles were everywhere. But they're all pretty small. The skulls are quite small, so that would, you know, be presumably the best adaptation for any species that wanted to be in that environment was change your body size.
Right. And that's even reflected today, where if you consider how crocodilians are distributed globally, you have some species that bleed into more temperate areas, and those species are never as big as the species that are in more tropical areas, right? Because they have to deal with much more extreme shifts in climate just on an annual cycle. Mm-hmm.
In terms of like jumping back to that dinosaur event, do you know much about how they survived through that particular event?
Personally, I don't. I'm not sure that I've even seen things that are... I'm sure that people are kind of asking the question, but I haven't seen much of
it. From what I understood from the program I listened to, it was to do with the fact that there were the species which survived, the crocodilian species which survived, were linked to fresh water, which is presumably linked to like dead stuff floating in and then carrion. So in terms of how crocodiles function, I mean, they're hunters, but they're also opportunists, and we've been watching them for weeks. And what's really fascinating is just how energy efficient they are. They can just sit still for hours and, you know, do nothing. And then when the prey comes, they burst into life within a split second.
Yeah.
So, you know, the challenge as a human being trying to film them is sitting there and maintaining the same level of attention that they're able to do, so that the minute when something happens is you're ready to go. So I think I, having been around you, and also Steve, the director's obviously done a huge amount of reading about crocodiles because he's doing a whole episode on crocodiles. They're really fascinating, both sort of anatomically and metabolically, you know, the use of oxygen and all of that. So can we just talk through how they function metabolically and what makes them so sort of unique as a group and a species?
Well, so here I can give you some broad strokes, but it's not been my specific domain of study. So a lot of the details, I'm not up to date on the latest science, but you know, I mean, so as cold-blooded, so another name for cold-blooded is heterothermic. Basically, it just means that like your temperature is going to vary over the course of whatever time scale, the day usually, whereas like a human, we're burning calories and that at a constant rate, and that enables us, it forces us actually to keep a fairly constant body temperature. And then we have to kind of continuously eat to feed that metabolic need, right? Whereas crocodilians, it's the reverse. You know, they kind of, their body temperature is really low in the morning, high at the peak of the day, and low at night again, because as the sun comes out and or they're sunning themselves, etc. And then because a lot of those metabolic processes are temperature dependent, if they're constantly in cold periods, whether it's at night or the winter time, then they kind of shut down a lot of their metabolic needs and they're not expending energy. They're literally just kind of sitting there. They're not in a comatose or catatonic state or anything. And as you said, they can very quickly and easily jump into action, and they're kind of always ready. So it has to be, you know, maybe there's a definitely difference between their brain function, level of their brain function, and their physical function. It makes it puts them in a very good position to be very efficient converters of energy, and it makes it so they don't really need to eat for periods of time if they don't want to. So, you know, for example, in the wintertime in the southeastern United States, especially in the northern part of the range, I mean, alligators freeze under lakes for a couple months.
Really?
They just put their noses up above water. The lake will freeze in, including them, as long as they can breathe the entire wintertime. And they just drop their metabolism to basically zero.
But I mean, that's presumably like if their noses are in frozen ice, then they're like below freezing.
Yeah, so it wouldn't necessarily be in a block of ice, but like if the surface of the lake freezes.
Yeah, but I mean, I mean that's still pretty cold because I mean, there is, you know, I remember talking to a sort of a fish scientist who explained that, you know, fish are able to survive because once the air, the top layer's frozen, you get this sort of thermocline where the cold water drops to the bottom, but then that insulates the layer above. So they'd be at a constant temperature if they were in liquid water, because that will not go below a certain temperature.
So their bodies are in that liquid water portion, and then just it's like this, you know, the thickness of the ice worth of their snout is in ice.
That's still pretty extraordinary to think of them functioning in frozen environments.
And they're not really functioning, they're just in kind of a stasis, they're waiting for it to come out. And then you get other species.
So they don't, and they don't feed that whole time, presumably.
Not at all.
So that's for possibly like month or 2 months.
1 to 3 months, call it, depending on the winter and the location, And you get other species which do something similar, but not temperature-related, but water-related.
Right.
So these crocodiles, West African crocodiles, this new Nile crocodile species, in the Sahara. So you get these populations in Mauritania, Mali, Chad, they used to be in Libya, up into Algeria as well, where you know, way back, we're talking 20,000 years ago or more, there used to be, you know, the Green Sahara, which was much, that had huge water bodies running through it and lots of vegetation and all these species that don't exist there anymore, including crocodiles, hippos, and everything else. And then, but as that started to kind of dry down, the Sahara became the Sahara we know today, there were still kind of remnant or relictual kind of habitats, like wetland habitats that have, you know, that are kind of centered on oases, you know, ground springs and stuff in these desert habitats. And crocodiles occupy those habitats still where they've been able to eke it out. And when the water disappears, they'll go underground for 9 months sometimes and just wait for the waters to, the rains to come back. They won't eat, they won't move, they won't necessarily be like, they won't have the same sort of, you know, state of torpor like a hibernating bear or something will.
I mean, because it's almost like a reverse hibernation, because the big issue that they will have then is keeping their body temperature down.
Which is why they go underground.
Right.
So they build and excavate these burrows or go into rock caves or something like that. It's a constant temperature, and usually on the cool end.
Right.
Compared to the environment. And then, you know, the rains come, and then, you know, the fish come out of the soils because they've been kind of stuck in soil.
Yeah, they're like these lungfish that get baked into the mud.
Exactly. So then all these aquatic things just like erupt to life for somewhere between 4 and 12 weeks of the year, do everything they need to do. So they eat, they build up their body weight, they reproduce, they hatch out the eggs, they feed their young for just enough time for the dry season to come again.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, wow. So are they the distinct species that those crocodiles who do that, or are they part of another species?
They're part of this wide-ranging but newly recognized West African Nile crocodile, or West African crocodile, the Crocodilosuchus.
Yeah. Right. Wow. But presumably those ones that are in the deserts looking to sort of survive through the heat, they also would have smaller body sizes so that they don't overheat, right?
Exactly, yeah. And so they don't overheat, so they have less energetic demands. I mean, these things, you know, their average size. I remember so I was working at a spot in northeastern Uganda one time, Kidepo Valley National Park, and we went there because this is like the site of this, you know, famous publications by the colonial Ugandan game warden, J.R. Pittman at the time. He's like, and they have these tiny little crocodiles in Kidepo. It's really weird. They're Nile crocodiles, and everyone says they're so vicious, but they stay very, very small. Like, no one had ever heard of one, like, bigger than a meter, let's say. And, and even today, when, you know, we went there, this is in 2010, the game wardens and all the rangers were like, oh, yeah, no, we see the crocodiles in these spaces. They're all, like, this big. And our very first day, we actually ended up catching a just slightly over 2-meter animal. It was a 2.3-meter animal, which, as far as crocs go, is not very big. But their minds were so blown that a crocodile this big was in their park because they'd never seen it. And this is, like, clearly the one dominant male that had been kind of breeding all these females in the hangout. And, you know, he's kind of... And, oh, you know, over the course of the time, we found a couple more animals that were about his size and whatever. But the average population is, like, 1.5 meters, which is exceptionally small. For a species that normally doesn't breed until 2 meters or bigger, you all of a sudden have these populations that are in these very extreme isolated environments where the females are breeding presumably as small as 1.5, 1.6 meters. The males barely get to be breeding size for the species globally.
Right, yeah, and presumably what's happened there is that those animals that got to sexual maturity smaller had an advantage,
passed on their genes earlier, ensured survival, all that stuff. Yeah, it's a fitness advantage. Exactly.
So metabolically, you know, what are the things that they're doing that are making them so unique as an animal? I mean, I'm thinking about like the use of oxygen and the way they can almost shut down parts of their body and stuff like that.
Yes, and then we're definitely getting into an area that's a bit outside of my expertise, so I'm not going to be able to go down a rabbit hole with you on it.
Right, okay. Because it's really fascinating how they work morphologically, metabolically so on. So in terms of moving on from that, what was the path that led you to... I mean, 2002, you first
came to Africa to study birds.
To study birds?
Yeah.
So, take me through it. I know that you had reptiles as a child, but...
Yeah.
So, you grew up in Florida.
Grew up in Florida.
National, or state animal is...
Well, sadly, it's freaking mockingbird, but it should be the alligators, popularly the alligator, of course.
But is there Florida, doesn't Florida State University have the gators?
University of Florida gators. So, you know, we're surrounded by all these reptiles and stuff, and I was always one to be keen on reptiles. As you said, I had reptiles in my house, and literally wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling, terrariums and vivariums all over my bedroom, and I caught my first pet snake at, you know, the age of 8, just before moving to Florida, and it just kind of went downhill from there. I was always into animals, but then, you know, I kind of got sidetracked a little bit. When I was in university, I did a study abroad in Australia and got really into birds because I just had a professor who was super into birds, and he was just, you know, the bug kind of bit me. And then I created this opportunity to go to Equatorial Guinea in Central Africa in 2002 and 2003 as a bright and bushy-tailed undergrad. To study birds, but while we were there, because I had this lifelong interest in reptiles, I knew that there were a couple of species of crocodile in the area, especially dwarf crocodiles. And I was like, oh man, I really want to see dwarf crocodiles, and I really want to see slender-centered crocodiles. And so while we're out doing bird surveys, one of our guides, of course, was a hunter from the local village, and I talked to him. He's like, yeah, let's go out, we'll find one. And of course we found them, they're pretty easy to find, and it was really fantastic. And then, you know, we got back to the city after this, you know, long field stand. We've got to know a bit more about the bushmeat trade or the wild meat trade in Equatorial Guinea, and dwarf crocodiles are heavily harvested for wild meat. Because, you know, they're small, they're easy to capture, they're kind of limited in habitats, people can just kind of go into it and grab them, and then when you grab them, you just have to shut their, like, secure their mouths with a piece of tape or a vine or whatever it is, and you can transport them alive and keep them alive for a really long time, which means in comparison to, let's say, Red River hogs or porcupine or whatever, you don't have to kill them, smoke them, or salt them. It's a fresh meat, right? And, of course, they're pretty abundant across the landscape, and so I learned about this when I was in Equatorial Guinea, and I was like, huh, I wonder what we're doing about this, or what we're studying, what we know about it. And it turns out that, you know, virtually no one had studied crocodiles anywhere in Central or West Africa. There are all these questions ranging from sustainable harvest to ecology and evolution. What are the animals doing? Just what are these species all about? And so I just kind of made the opportunity to do my master's and my PhD on them. And of course, as I got more and more into crocs, you know, I always liked them, and I was always fascinated. How are you a young kid who likes reptiles without being fascinated by crocodilians, right? They're kind of, you know, the kings of the crocodile, or the kings of the reptile world. And but then as I got more and more into it, what I found to be very pleasing was that crocodiles are very interesting. They're not really model organisms, you know, they're not fruit flies, but they're very interesting study systems for lots of cool questions in ecology and evolution and conservation science. You know, this anything from the stuff that we've been talking about, you know, what's the relationship between changing environments and crocodile morphology, physiology, etc., to, you know, the fact that, you know, even if we recognize 35 crocodile species eventually, compared to the hundreds of crocodile species that existed in the past, that's basically nothing. And so when you try to resolve crocodilian phylogenies, the relationships between species, you end up with all these issues where different data sets give you different answers. And one of the main explanatory factors for that is because you have just a very depauperate contemporary record to sample crocodilians from, to reconstruct genomes and the relationships and all that stuff. So that's really fascinating. And then, you know, then when you get into stuff like conservation, you have kind of two models, let's say, in the world today. We have the highly protectionist model, and we have the model that is open to natural resource use, hopefully in a sustainable way. And so highly protectionist species, you get, you know, this is stuff like chimpanzees and gorillas and koalas and pandas and stuff, where basically the main conservation solutions are find the best habitat, put a fence around it, in quotes, maybe it's an actual fence or not, but you guard it and you say, look, at best, we're going to let you come and take photos of these species, and you're going to pay your park entry fee and whatever else. It's fine.
Yeah.
But then you have sustainable use models, or let's say models which are much more open to not strictly protectionist means. And those tend to be species that can handle some level of harvest. And especially if you can kind of create a value chain or commodity chain that starts from the ground, so local communities are somehow involved, and then you build the value of that commodity up to the global West or the global consumption group and transform its value along the way. So let's say you start from eggs. In the case of crocodilians, you start with eggs. Local communities harvest eggs for you and you pay them for those. And then they all of a sudden are incentivized to protect their environment, to protect the species, so they can keep getting money from them over and over again. And then those go into the next level where the eggs are kind of hatched and raised, and then those people sell the babies, just like a typical farming system, whether it's chickens, cows, or broccoli. And then eventually those products make their way up to the high fashion luxury industry in the world, where, you know, you get Birkin bags selling from Mayer Mez for $35,000 a pop. It's a little handbag. And even more than that, you get some much more expensive and valuable products. And so, you know, this has created a system that has actually allowed crocodilians, many of the species, to rebound from this period in the 50s and 60s where they were decimated and eradicated before we kind of understood what sustainability was.
So what you're suggesting is that the crocodilians have accidentally been part of designing a system which is more sustainable than the model of, like, if you'd said, all right, we just have to fence these crocodiles off here, here, and here, you know, in these prime areas, and that's a crocodile sanctuary, that actually, by making them part of a chain of harvesting and sort of financial value, that they've actually benefited from that.
Yeah, and so actually, if you look across the world globally in the 50s and 60s, almost every crocodile species was highly reduced populations. I mean, the American alligator, which is today recognized as one of the most abundant crocodile, probably the most abundant crocodile in the world. I mean, we were literally within 3 zeros of population size of American alligators being eradicated from the earth. Like, there were like thousands of individuals left, not hundreds of thousands or more.
Wow.
And then, you know, so then we kind of recognized this, put some protections in place, and those populations started to rebound. And we said, okay, well, one of the reasons these animals are going extinct in the past is because people were harvesting them for one reason or another, meat, skins, etc. So we said, okay, well, let's find a way to do this sustainably. And then so we implemented a system that had less impact on the population than what was happening before. And now, as a result, American alligators, we estimate the global population somewhere in the 4 to 6 million range. In the 40 years, they've rebounded by four orders of magnitude because they're such a high value environmental commodity, right? And so if you look across the world today, and that same history kind
of exists. Was that the American wildlife?
It was the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, or the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission.
You know, this is one of the things about a sort of an American perspective on ecology, is that it is driven by the experience of managing your wildlife through hunting and licensing, right? Because it goes hand in hand with gun ownership and all of that. So, you know, that Second Amendment...
It helps a bit. Helps a bit for sure.
Well, it's ironic.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a thing that a lot of people wouldn't acknowledge, right? But it's part of the picture.
It's part of the picture. And for better or worse, it's not uniquely American. I mean, if you look at the Southern African model of wildlife management, for example, this is where the campfire model was born. The campfire is this massive, it's a community-centered approach to species conservation, where people acknowledge that people do not live isolated from the landscape and all the other things that live in there. And so as long as you find a way for people to kind of live harmoniously with the environment and they benefit and the environment benefits, then all of a sudden you kind of achieve sustainability. And so the countries in South Africa, Southern Africa region, have really locked onto this, like, campfire, or let's say similar and evolved adaptive models of it, tend to have much more wildlife than the countries which have a strict preservation style approach.
So, I mean, what you're suggesting would be an argument for harvesting rhino horn.
Yeah, potentially.
I mean, because there's been a debate in that sort of... but the problem is that once you get into this idea of people have these sort of emotional attachments to these big animals, don't they? Like, whether they're elephants or rhinos or whatever, they view them as a sort of like a sacred object. But I mean, yeah, I guess the question is, why would there be an ethical or emotional value on killing a rhino as opposed to a cow?
Right.
I mean, what's the fundamental difference between the act of killing either one of those animals? It has the same, they possibly have the same level of sentience and consciousness or whatever. Is that sort of a fair summary of you know, that idea of creating a chain of that enables you to sustainably harvest something?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the bottom line is that people in particular do not value things that they do not see as valuable. And so there's lots of people that make these very strong arguments for the intrinsic value of things, species, wildlife, whatever, diamonds, whatever it happens to be, right? And that's true. But when it push comes to shove, and you're talking about families needing to feed themselves, mm-hmm. and people needing to secure their future and make it to tomorrow and provide themselves running water and all this sort of stuff, those intrinsic value arguments kind of fall away.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what we get into is the really kind of the tangible, actual monetary value. And this sounds very mercenary, and I don't like it any more than anybody else does. Like, I wish that everyone just recognized the intrinsic value of the world and we found a way to live in harmony with nature. But, you know, in the face of that not being realistic, you have to all of a sudden ascribe monetary value to things. And if you don't, then those things go away.
Mm. So, and you know, the fact is that you have a very informed perspective on that, because the species in which you happen to have a special interest, right, is a direct example of how that would work.
Well, it's not only a direct example, but it's actually the poster child.
Right.
Crocodilians are the poster children for how sustainable wildlife use can be successful.
Mm.
You know, and crocodilians have kind of paved the way for lots of other species in terms of like policy reform, practice reform, and kind of creating value chains out of actual wildlife. And then not only that, but linking those value chains back to, and this is where it gets really important, land tenure.
Right.
And land ownership. And you know, so the main, let's say the you know, the most successful example of this in the world is, go back to the United States, in like southern Louisiana, for example, and even in southern Florida, where landowners have a couple of options. They can keep natural marsh on their land, which in and of itself has very little value to you as a landowner, right? You know, you can do your recreational activities, you can fish and hunt and whatever else, but if you can do nothing commercial on it, then you get no returns from that land. If all of a sudden one of the commercial values is the alligator population that's in the marsh that's in your backyard, and you can harvest the eggs out of there and sell them every year, then that incentivizes you to keep the marsh instead of draining the marsh and creating, let's say, a sugar cane plantation, right, or a fish farm or whatever it happens to be.
So they've in the specific example, just so I'm clear, with alligators in America, the model is around the eggs that they harvest. In that situation, is it like, okay, you harvest 50% of the eggs, like you're supposed to leave some there, or is there a protocol for that? How does it work?
Yeah, no, there's absolutely a protocol. And so, yeah, you know, the state every year decides how many nests are allowed to be harvested based on their population surveys, the number of females they identify in the population, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. You harvest every egg from the nest that you harvest, but you don't harvest every nest.
Right.
And the principle here is that, you know, the mortality at the egg stage is very, very high. Naturally,
because right. nests so the nest flood, that you predators, all this the nest stuff. That you leave has a very high chance that very few will come to maturity.
Well, no, it's actually the opposite. It's the nest that you take had a very low chance of ever coming to maturity.
Right.
So by basically being complicit with the natural mortality, you don't impact the system.
Right.
And then the nests that remain, they're allowed to hatch out and grow out. And then, you know, early on, these programs started with a head start. So you'd take 5 or 10%, you'd release them back into the wild after like a year of growth, get them past that high mortality phase.
Right.
Most programs have stopped that.
So that was from the 50s and 60s onwards?
It really started in the 70s, 70s, right. 80s is when it started.
And is there a particular, I've never heard of this. I know that there's a lot of alligators in... Mm. You know, if you go to NASA in Florida, you'll see alligators by the side of the road, right? But I didn't realize that they'd got down to such a small population. And to go from several thousand to 4 to 6 million, I mean, that's incredible.
It's amazing. Yeah.
That's amazing. Like you say, many orders of magnitude of growth in, you know, 4 decades.
Yeah.
Was there a particular scientist or a particular sort of set of scientific data that informed that, or why?
Yeah. I mean, of course, we know the field of crocodilian science and crocodilian management has its godfathers. Some of them are still alive today, in fact, and still kind of are at the head of the group, and some of them are just kind of retiring out of the different game agencies of the world and stuff. But yeah, it's basically their insights, their deep understanding of the species and how the species are tied to the land, which allowed them to do that. And allowed them to convince landowners and local communities to do that as well.
Mm. But there was also, I mean, you do have also the weight of a federal body. I mean, all of these bodies in America, like the Bureau of Land Management and the, you know, Fisheries and Wildlife, I mean, they do have political clout, you know, and they have legal clout.
But they have less clout than the individual landowners and the lobbyists for those landowners. And so this kind of brings me back to what I was saying before. If those landowners in Louisiana are deciding to protect their land, it means they're protecting the wetlands. When you protect the wetlands, you protect all the species that are in the wetlands, including the fisheries, which are also an economically important resource to the state of Louisiana. And you're doing things like, well, like wetlands, freshwater wetlands contribute inordinately to like carbon sequestration and you know, erosion control and fresh water, like, you know, water, the water cycle and these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And they kind of prevent massive flooding after hurricanes and stuff because they kind of absorb the discharge and stuff. And so you end up with all these secondary positive benefits that are way less tangible for the individual landowner. But if all of a sudden you alter the landscape because everyone was like, no, it's so passe, we're not doing alligators anymore, then you'd have real problems. You'd have real problems.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because when you reflect on, you know, one of the things that I'm been really interested to learn about is soil and farming and regenerative farming, and the model where we impose on a landscape a set of artificial conditions. I mean, I think about this in the, you know, I live in Cotswolds, which is an area of outstanding natural beauty. So it's an area that is recognised as having a distinct sort of, you know, character, if you like, of being of national significance and therefore worth recognizing. It affects some planning, so you can't do certain things, you can do other things, but it's pretty loose on the heart. But recognizing that environment, but even so, you know, Britain is predominantly a monoculture.
Yeah,
you know, it's wheat and it's, you know, barley. And you know what's really interesting is that the model that sort of crocodilians and this bounce back of species is perhaps suggesting is, no, what's the environment that was already there and how do we use that environment to generate resources rather than imposing our resources on it? Because what monoculture is doing is destroying the quality of our soil. And the National Farmers Union in the UK says 50 harvests. The American farmers say 50 to 60 harvests, because we're going, now this land, we're putting corn on it, we're putting maize on it. But actually, if you think about crocodiles as a crop, ironically, then you preserve their environment and you, it's a way of thinking that I've never clicked in my brain before. Yeah. But this conversation about crocodiles, funnily, is kind of put a way of putting it into perspective.
Yeah. It's interesting if you have some better understanding of the value of an intact environment. And I think, you know, I mean, I found the stuff we were talking about regenerative farming practices. I mean, that's the whole principle, is you kind of value a comprehensive environment and nature's ability to rehabilitate itself.
Yeah.
On a cyclical basis, because if you think about it, that's what happens every single year, right? Every single year. And if you kind of work with nature instead of against it, there's a lot more evidence coming out, not just from like soil science, but from anything, you know, air quality, water quality, even people's quality of life, just because whether you recognize it or not, I mean, green spaces are incredibly important to your psychological well-being. I mean, like, everything about it suggests that the more that we can leave in the environment intact and work with it to be productive, the more sustainable it is, the more productive it's going to be, and the better off everybody is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a way, when people talk about rewilding, and I know that there's a lot of sort of conservationists who are using that.
A lot of baggage
that
on the word rewilding as well.
Well, that, yeah, I mean, what it suggests is that you're abandoning that environment to nature. And again, that provides a separation from human beings. You know, there's lots of bad use of terminology around in the world at the moment for political reasons. And it feels a bit like, I mean, we shouldn't be talking about rewilding as a form of separating us off, because what we're actually talking about is what is the environment was there and how do we use it? So, for instance, you know, there's a big project in the south of England where they've rewilded a farm, they actually have cattle on it, but the cattle are allowed to graze, and they actually graze a much wider range of species.
Mm-hmm.
They're therefore healthier. They have like,
yeah.
So it's not about the idea. To me, the idea of rewilding suggests you're removing human beings from the environment, and what you're suggesting that crocodilian, the success of the crocodilian, the alligators in America is actually about going no. Human beings are intrinsic to the environment, but we yeah. have to give them a value for the existing environment rather than saying, replace that, like you said, with a sugar farm. You know, if you can make money from the environment that's already there.
Yeah.
But does that sort of also suggest that you have to educate people to not just want to eat their nice beef steaks,
yeah.
you know, and have a wider sort of range of interests and in terms of what we eat and consume, is that?
Yeah, it's totally accurate, and especially when you consider that the global West, let's call it, what is it, like 95% of the food that we consume isn't grown within several thousand kilometers of where it's being consumed. I mean, mm-hmm. that's huge secondary impacts and stuff, but if people were more willing to recognize how intricately linked they are to the environment,
mm-hmm.
and then just embrace that, mm. and go with the annual cycles and kind of
eat
work
rabbit
with, eat mm. rabbit instead of factory farmed pig or goat or something yeah, yeah. or whatever it is, you know, where you know if you live in the southwestern United States or the southeast United States, wear crocodile leather instead of bovine leather.
Yeah,
because the impact on the environment,
because the bovine leathers probably come from Argentina.
Yeah, exactly. On a factory farm, on a landscape that was cleared to make room for that cattle, yeah. on the soybeans that were, you know.
So wearing a pair of alligator boots in that case isn't like a statement of some sort of humanistic hubris. Is actually more environmentally.
Well, it can be both, you know.
Yeah.
Gotta give people their petty pies, you know, it's
yeah,
fine.
Sure. But what I mean is that, you know, you would tend to see someone wearing like a crocodile boots and go, oh my God, what an arsehole, like he's wearing crocodiles. But actually, if you're in the southern states of America, it's like, no, that's probably the best thing to make your boots out of because it's got the same qualities
yeah.
as
yeah.
leather, but it's local
and it's local, it's sustainable, it's yeah,
so in terms of where you're going with your research, I know that you're developing programs to actually support and train African
mm.
so are you still is that research more about environment and conservation, or is it still crocodile focused?
Well, so crocodiles are kind of, let's say, our flagship, crocodiles and mm. pangolins, and so, you know, a lot of the research questions we ask and a lot of the conservation and management interventions we attempt to implement, we could do that on a number of species or at the ecosystem scale or whatever, but everyone's kind of got their hook. And our hook is species, and specifically crocodiles, pangolins, and some others that are like them. And then, you know, one of the things that I recognized very, very early on when working in West and Central Africa is, fuck, dude, you're out here all by yourself.
Yeah.
There's nobody that's doing this with you. Like, I couldn't arrive in Gabon and call up, you know, the Gabonese crocodile specialist and do some work with them.
But right? The local people, I mean, we had a guy, Fabrice, who was working with us. They know a lot about the animals.
Yeah, yeah. So traditional, you know, so I'm not going to call it traditional, say local knowledge mm. of the species is very helpful, but it's different than, you know, let's say you're a scientist and you're working yeah. at a scientific level and you're working with institutions to do conservation reform. At least where I am, and this is not making a statement about the value of integrating local communities or not into the conservation, it's just where I kind of come into this picture. You know, lots of people can rock up into Gabon or Kenya or wherever it is and work with their counterpart, their local counterpart, as an expert on X, Y, or Z because it exists, because people have had the interest in the past, or there's enough funding for it, or people aren't afraid of it, or whatever it happens to be, you know. Mm. But with crocodilians, it's never been the case. I've always been kind of by myself. I've always had to identify people in country who have said, oh, actually, I do kind of, I'm interested in crocodiles. And there's always these people. And kind of take them, foster that interest, mm. build it into a passion, and then kind of leave a local champion in place, right? And that's right. The only way it's really going to happen. You get these people who start out young, they start out interested in whatever species, they do a little bit of research on it or something as part of an academic degree maybe, and then they go and join the national park system. Well, if their focus has always been elephants or always been birds or whatever, that's what they're going to bring into those positions. Mm. And the other species are going to be of interest, but they're not going to be as important. Mm. So as we, you know, as we slowly
looking at whole systems,
looking at change, not tomorrow, but in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, as these people that we're working on are kind of moving into the right positions. And so it's kind of funny, you know, I actually, at the very beginning of this, you asked me, how do I describe myself? What's my position? I was like, I'm a species scientist. That's what I love to do, right? This is how I kind of fancy myself. But in reality, I'm like a transformer of human passions, if you will, right? Like, I mean, like, conservation is a real people problem.
Yeah.
One, from one reason or another. But, and so my kind of answer to this has always been, how do I develop the interest and the capacity in the people to, you know, diversify their conservation portfolios, to care about these species they haven't always cared about and stuff. And so that's really what we spent a lot of energy on.
Yeah, I mean, jumping back, you know, talking about sort of taking these big iconic species like rhino and chimpanzee and lion and elephant and like building a fence around them. And going, human beings don't really have anything to do with them. This is the wild, and everything outside is not the wild.
Mm.
I mean, it's difficult to see how that can be a sustainable model for conservation, because ultimately conservation is about people.
Yeah.
You have to have people on board. People, especially in the developing world, have to have resources they can exploit. Because we've, in the West, have been exploiting ours. I mean, you know, we've plenty of species that we've sent extinct in the West. I'm thinking about, you know, buffalo and even the doves. What are the pigeons? Wasn't there a species of dove or duck that was completely wiped out in the States?
Yeah, just pasture pigeon.
All right, yeah. So, you know, unless we make those things joined up, if you just... The only way that people have the ability to make money out of a resource that's fenced off is if they work to guard it, or they're like working on the restaurant that rich Westerners are coming to eat from, right? But if it's a joined up system and the people are invested in the environment, so conservation is ultimately about how you bring the people into the environment rather than segregate the environment from the people to protect
it. It's a very recurring theme, eh?
Yeah. it's also an interesting perspective. I mean, the problem with it is that it leads you to some very uncomfortable conclusions, right? Like, elephants or rhinos, like, maybe we should be harvesting their... You know, they're harvesting their rhino horn. Like, the conclusions are not comfortable because the way that we have the model of these big iconic animals and also, I mean, it doesn't help when you have images of trophy hunters standing on the head of an elephant all triumphant, because your instant reaction is, what a dick.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And,
you
know, even if that dick has contributed tens of thousands of dollars to the local community, which is then going to sustain elephants in the long term, in terms of like propaganda, that's not great. But the logical conclusion of what we're talking about is that if we try and isolate those species from these systems that involve people, we're doomed to fail, right?
Basically, and then the simple reason for that is, if you try to isolate the system, the species, from the systems that involve people, and especially if you tell the people, well, you can't benefit from them by harvesting them or trophy hunting them or something, well, their answer is, let's just get rid of them and put cattle there, or a sugarcane plantation, or whatever it is. And so, like, you're not, at the end of the day, actually saving anything. You're just kind of resulting in...
If you're saying, okay, you kill an elephant for its tusks and you're going to go to prison, right? Somebody who doesn't want to go to prison is going to go, well, I'm going to have to farm beetroot or maize or whatever it is, okay? Then they go, how do I do that? I burn down a bit of forest in order to farm it. Now what you've done is you've reduced the ability of the elephant to survive, because you've replaced their habitat with a human-managed habitat.
And you brought in all this food that the elephant also wants to eat, so then you've increased your conflict with the elephant, and then you put yourself in this vulnerable position where you might have to kill the elephant to keep your plantation from being raided, and it's just, it's a very kind of a vicious cycle.
But I mean, you know, you could imagine going on Twitter or like social media and like advocating for like effective management of elephants through harvesting, right?
You get slaughtered by the public outcry.
Could you imagine? I mean, people wouldn't even seek to understand the arguments.
Well, they don't. Yeah, they don't. Even today, they don't.
Mm. And, you know, people have, you know, even around hunting in the US, where there's a clear example of how hunting contributes massively to the environmental well-being.
Mm.
I mean, the entire Fisheries and Wildlife Agency of America is funded by the hunting license.
Hunting and fishing.
So how do you overcome that? How do you...
That's a really tough one, because, I mean, people tend to hold dearly to their views and their values, and kind of convincing someone that the way that they perceive things isn't actually appropriate or reality is nearly impossible in most cases. And,
especially with a species like, you know, elephant or gorilla, where, you know, I'm just thinking of those iconic images that you are constantly confronted with, and of these magnificent animals. They're the poster children, aren't they, of conservation? And yet the irony is, are the strategies that are seeking to conserve them really effective for their conservation?
Well, so for me, the simplest answer to this question is, let's not have the debate in an elevated ivory tower Western Hemisphere sort of context. If we're talking about elephants and how to conserve elephants, let's go to Zambia and have the conversation with the Zambian communities and the Zambian government and the Zambian Park Service. And sure, I mean, bring people that are informed, and if you really want to make the debate very interesting, bring a whole bunch of people that are uninformed but have very loud voices and have very loud passions, mm-hmm. and just, you know, pit them against each other and have the debate. But in reality, as far as I'm concerned, people in England and the United States shouldn't even have a voice in how elephants are managed in Africa, because it's not our problem. We are effectively the largest donor community, but if we want to move away from the donor-driven model of conservation, which isn't sustainable in any way, shape, or form, and actually do it in an integrated sort of way, we have to shift the power base.
Yeah, I mean, there is... frankly, a kind of colonial attitude attached to the donations, which is like, we donate, but we know what's best for how you manage your animals.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
You know, and if you're an American donor, the irony there is that if you're an American donor saying, I'm going to tell you how to manage elephants, but you're a part of a system where an entire species has gone from several thousand to several million because of strategies that were used by your own government service, but you're blind to that and you're just imposing that. I mean, there's a kind of a colonial sort of imposition there, isn't it?
It's very uncomfortable to look at and think about.
It is, really. I mean, because, you know, I have the same emotional reaction to these species, you know. You're trained to. Right? You know, you read kids' books, don't you? Simba the Lion, Dumbo the Elephant, Baba the Elephant. You know, I mean, you have these tropes imprinted on you in the West from a very, very early age. But what you never have in Baba the Elephant or whatever is the image of the local community that actually lives with those animals.
Yeah, yeah. And you mix that in with a very large dose of luxury and privilege, and then you have the magic formula for a bunch of people who think they should have a voice in something they shouldn't.
But are people putting their head above the parapet? Are people making this argument? Because I've heard the argument, for instance, like, we've got the wrong strategy with rhinos. We need to breed them, right, in captivity, and manage the selling of their horn. Like, I've heard that argument made. Which means that somebody's put their head above the parapet to make that argument. Are there people doing that in the conservation world?
There are. I mean, the numbers are... It's actually hard to say who... Because if you look at the conservation world and you try to define what that means, it's very kind of hard to draw a line around it, because you have a bunch of people who feel as though they're in the conservation world, when you have a bunch of other people that feel as though those people are not. And so it's very hard to kind of put a line around it. But there is a huge voice in favor of sustainable use activities and indigenous peoples and local communities led activities.
So to be clear, that would mean things like trophy landing,
harvesting alligators, whatever it is, mm-hmm. or at least giving the decision-making power to the stewards of the land,
mm.
who are, in some cases, indigenous peoples, in other cases, local communities, or just the state residents, government, state yeah. governments, whatever it happens to be. Mm. And then you have a whole bunch of other people who are trying to in basically force their value system over top of those.
With money.
And so this is where I was going with this. Is like the people that tend up, you know, the people that I would say are questionably mm. in the conservation circles. These are people who end up being the most outspoken against anything that involves sustainable land management and mm. sustainable wildlife use and giving the decision-making power to local communities and stuff. They end up being super well-resourced because what they can do in the United States and in England is get Sarah McLachlan to get on TV and sing a very sad song while puppies are dying in the streets and generate this massive donor base. And so when you're talking about, you know, one of these organizations who shall remain nameless, even though I'm sure we all know who I'm talking about, they have millions upon millions of dollars to do these ad campaigns to influence social media and get into people's minds and somehow convince them that this stuff, which is very right, very ethical, very moral, very sustainable, is wrong somehow. And then you get these huge inconsistencies.
It's emotionally loaded arguments.
Totally.
I mean, and yeah. that's probably why they use social media to get the message out.
For sure.
Because social media is the direct brain hack into our emotional response system.
Yeah.
It's like, what makes you angry? Like, and that's why those trophy hunters are kind of handing the argument to the wrong side, right?
Yeah.
Because what they're doing is they're making it very easy for you to oppose trophy hunting. Because, mm-hmm. like, standing on the head of an elephant with a fucking gun so you get a picture of it is like, you know, I can understand. But it's a bit like when I have family or friends who are like, I went to Paris and then want to show me a photo of them standing in front of the Eiffel Tower. It's like, well, I believe you were in Paris. Like, and I know what you look like, and I know what the Eiffel Tower looks like, so I don't need a photo of you in front of the Eiffel Tower, and I don't need to waste 5 minutes of my life looking at it.
Yeah.
You know, so that whole trophy hunter...
Think of it this way, right? So, okay, don't be wrong.
I'm just saying it's an own goal. Like.
Right, but like, why... So, this is the thing that I find fascinating about, like, the psychology of the human community is mm. we find it... Some people find it reprehensible that some guy standing there with, you know, doing the Captain Morgan pose on a lion head that he just, you know, just killed this animal. While a lot of those same people will think nothing about Instagramming a picture of their, you know, locally caught seafood dinner.
Or their new shoes that they've just bought.
Or
their made
new
from
shoes,
leather.
Or that fancy car that they just bought, that, you know, the carbon implications and the fuel implications.
That's got, Italian leather on
exactly,
the seats.
Exactly. It's
Yeah, there's a disconnect there, but it's about the iconography of it, isn't it? I mean, that's the reality is the iconography war is being won by the idea of the big, noble, wildlife animal that we have to protect that's being predated by humans, and humans are the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that iconography is the idea that humans could be the solution through sustainable use or whatever. And I'm not advocating for this because I don't know enough about it. These arguments and discussions that we're having are things that are kind of going through my mind as I'm hearing about different perspectives. I knew nothing about the bounce back of the alligator population.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how many people would be aware of that even in the States? Probably
not many.
So, you know, the iconography war is being won by the side with the biggest budget and the biggest ability to might give us emotional responses to stuff, and that's part of the problem with the entire information ecosystem right now.
Well,
how do you cut through it?
Well, I think also you have this other element that has been left unsaid today, but like if you have people that are so willing to play on your emotions to get their point across, that means they're also going to be fairly unscrupulous about the way in which they do that. So you end up with a bunch of people who are willing to, let's say, cherry pick the videos or, you know, cut things into production that weren't necessarily representative of the truth and accurately what happened in, let's say, an animal slaughterhouse, for example, or whatever. And you're pitting that up against a bunch of people who feel compelled to just 100% represent the truth at all times, whether it's good, bad, ugly, boring, dull, less emotionally like gut-wrenching and stuff. And so the messaging is going to be forcibly less. I mean, how many people, like, okay, if you take it as just a sampling of your friends and you were to show them and flash them a picture of a trophy hunter standing on a lion being, you know, Captain Morganing or
and
whatever,
go, is this guy A, a dick, B, a dick, or C, a really decent human being?
Right. Versus flashing, let's say, an oil refinery with a totally no natural environment around it. How many people are going to have the more reprehensible gut reaction to this one versus this one, right? Probably the trophy hunting one.
Yeah, right.
Right. But that oil refinery was built on previously 10,000 acres of a wetland that had to be drained. So you lost literally hundreds of thousands or millions of individuals of thousands of species that used to be there.
Right.
As opposed to this one individual animal with a guy who you just kind of like, he's like, it's like my personal Ben Affleck, right? He's like, I just gut reaction to this guy's face. I just want to punch it.
Yeah.
Because you're a dick. You shot that lion. Mm. But like, people don't ever think about all the...
Well, there's nobody to punch, is there?
Exactly. Well, you'd have to punch yourself, basically.
Yeah, of course. Or, you know, get off out of your car and stuff. So it's really interesting to me to think about the way that conservation is hampered by the human emotional response to the natural world so much, and you know, you just have this sort of visceral emotional reaction, and you're taught to have this visceral emotional reaction when it comes to wildlife, like it should be like this. And it strikes me, you know, I've thought quite a bit about going vegetarian. For instance, my son's vegetarian, and you know, my wife was vegetarian for a long time. But when I went to a regenerative farm, the thing that I realized is, you know, there are no natural environments where there are only plants and no animals.
Mm.
I mean, I'm unaware of any.
I mean, they can't really be natural anymore if they don't have animals, right?
Well, I mean, there's the Antarctic, I suppose you could argue, has animals without lots of plants. But I mean, you don't have any plant-based environments with no animals in them. But because they're part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And in regenerative farming, one of the models is you have to have animals on the land. You have to have different animals. You have to cycle them around. Their shit all contributes different things to the soil base, right? Mm. So if you start going, okay, well, let's just be purely vegetarian, and now we're just planting effectively monocultures to sustain human beings.
Which you have to protect from all the animal life, lest it impact your monoculture.
Right, because you've got a pesticide in it, and you can't have birds flying out on it, locusts are going to be in it, like all of that. But regenerative farming is a system that goes, all right, you can have, you know, you can farm, but you also have, you have pigs on there. You have, you know, they turn the ground up in a good way. You have cows on there. You have geese on there. The geese eat the snails, and you get, you know, you have chicken and turkey. Like, it's an integrated system, and we're emotionally like, oh, I don't want to eat an animal because I don't want to kill it. And I completely get that the way that factory farming of animals is unbelievably horrendous. I think in 100 years, we'll look back on how we farm animals now and just be just as appalled as we are looking back 150 years and thinking about child labor.
Yeah.
Do you know?
But the difference is, hopefully we will have solutions by then.
Right.
Instead of just a bunch of talking heads being like, no, you can't do that. Okay, well, how else can I do it?
Yeah, but I mean, I guess the thing that sort of reflecting was like, well, actually, there is no way we can have a successful future farming unless we integrate animals into that.
Mm.
You know, at the moment, animals are in one place and you grow crops from them and you feed them. And the crops that vegetable crops grow elsewhere, but the model of regenerative farming is you need all of those things to be on the land at different points. And it's kind of what we're talking about here. It's like the environment is not a single thing. It's a system.
Mm.
And actually, people are part of that system, right? I mean, that's...
Absolutely.
You know, so that's where you have to go. And if you... Are there any specific examples of where you're seeing people moving in the right direction in West Africa and embracing these ideas?
West Africa is a bit of a tough one because the environment has been so heavily degraded already.
Right.
And because of that, the prevailing ethos is one, even though, let's say, lots of West African people and traditional communities depend still very heavily on wild harvested protein sources and stuff,
mm-hmm.
the influence of conservation and governments are getting so shamed into allowing their people to continue doing these sorts of things and not being able to implement alternative solutions or complementary solutions, especially. But you know, a lot of this is really underpinned by heavy environmental degradation, that West Africa is a bit of a... It's a bit of an uphill battle for the moment. Mm. Southern Africa is a bit of a different story. There's lots of communities and lots of governments that have gone in that direction. I mean, take South Africa, for example. I mean, like the average, I saw an infographic just yesterday or 2 days ago where the average head of wildlife, so if you just take all the species in most East and Southern African countries that don't participate in some kind of sustainable use-based or wildlife production-based system is less than 1 million head of wildlife. And South Africa alone has something like 20 million head of wildlife.
So you're saying 19 million out of the 20 million is managed as a sort of sustainable farm?
Some of it's production, some of it's sustainable, some of it's just landowners deciding that wildlife on their land is more valuable than monoculture or beef on their land, that sort of stuff. And it's not just that it's
Africa. But you go to South Africa and you go to a restaurant, right? And on the restaurant menu, right, you get ostrich, you get crocodile.
Yeah.
You know, unless we change what people are prepared to accept as edible as well, that's part of the argument.
So take the United States, for example. We have a big hunting culture of, you know, ducks and deer, let's say. Just take those two, for example.
Yeah.
But, like, you can't go into... There's not, on average, one restaurant per town that serves those wild meat products.
Mm.
If you're a hunter, you have a friend, your friend's with a hunter, you'll get them and stuff. But like, we are heavily driven by mass produced factory farm sorts of systems. I don't really understand why that is. Some of it might have to do with some, you know, BS reasons. FDA can't control the meat quality and all that stuff. You don't want people getting sick and that's maybe fair enough. But a lot of it has to do with people's perceptions. You know, people are more comfortable was something that came from a farm than came from the wild.
Yeah, it's an odd question because, like, you know, I've got dogs and you can't be around animals without, like, understanding that they do have personalities.
Mm.
And, like, we've got, where I live, we have cattle. The cattle have a right to roam free, so local farmers can put their cattle on the common. And they often do so, and they often do so with pregnant cows, and so you have calves and stuff. We see different personalities in the cows that we see around us, but people don't attach personality to those animals in the same way as they do to the elephant and the lion and the chimpanzee. And it's almost like a convenient blindness, isn't it?
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how convenient it is in the end. It certainly works out for some of them.
I know we're running out of time, but I just wanted to ask you one thing, because it was like the idea for me of my child keeping snakes in their bedroom is just sort of a mystery. But was your family very encouraging of you doing that sort of stuff?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in many ways they didn't understand it themselves either, but they recognized that it was my passion and said, hey, let's do it, you know, let's promote it.
So I know that we saw a python here, so is a particular animal that you owned that has stayed with you that you you know, attachment that you formed to a particular...
Yeah, sadly, I don't have any animals of my own anymore, because with the lifestyle, it's very hard to maintain them. But I had a green tree python for, like, a little over 20 years, who was with me everywhere. I didn't bring her to Africa or anything, but, she went to grad school with me, she was in high school with me, she went to college with me. Super cool. Love that snake. And she passed away the day that I was moving out of where I did my graduate school. So like 20 years after I owned her, a little over 20 years, she was like, you're gone, you're not coming back, I'm out of here too. If you want to attach some value to it. I always really enjoyed having snakes in captivity. And then fish. I had always really enjoyed fish as well, because you can set up these cool little ecological microcosms and they behave very naturally. And
so, I mean, it seems to me really important that those kinds of passion in young people are encouraged and sort of nurtured, because it leads to you ultimately doing this thing that you do. But how do we encourage people to go and love their local snake or their... I mean, it's a reactive thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think the silly thing is that very few people are actually born with an innate fear of snakes. I mean, most kids will walk right up to them and just pick them up because they don't know that they may or may not be dangerous and stuff. Yeah. And it's really only after they get these terrifying reactions from their parents. Like, how many parents have you seen a kid picking up even just a cockroach? And the reaction isn't, just be careful with that. It's just like blood-curdling scream and this rush emergency situation and swatting it out of the hand and, dousing you in Purell and then, like, shaking and lecturing and, like, all this stuff. I mean, of course the kid's going to have this very visceral gut negative reaction to the next cockroach or snake that he sees. And so it's, if you can't find it in yourself to encourage the natural curiosity that kids have or encourage the passion that, let's say, the few weirdo individuals like myself have, at least fight the urge to just negatively imprint your fears and mostly irrational fears and lack of understanding, more importantly, onto those kids. Give them their own chance to decide, really.
Because we got, I think one of the things that I would take away from this conversation is that we have got to stop imprinting our values onto the natural world, and we've got to start letting the values of the natural world imprint on the way that we do things. And regenerative farming with animals on the land and not ploughing. These are natural systems. Like, we're not inventing anything, right? What we're doing is going, all these other ways that we've had of doing it, ploughing, fertilizing, pesticide, genetically modified seed.
Tax subsidies.
They're not great solutions. Yeah. We go back to the ones that were already in place in nature.
No, exactly.
So, that's what I would take away from this. And I'd encourage people to maybe become more conscious meat eaters rather than just jumping to be vegetarians as well, for example.
Exactly.
But thank you so much for your time, mate.
Oh, appreciate it.
It was a good conversation. I enjoyed it.
Cool.
Thanks so much for listening. The conversation with Matt really surprised me. I guess I knew that current conservation strategies weren't really working, but Matt's insights really made me think through the whole problem again, this time trying to incorporate the perspective of the people who live alongside the affected animals. I hope you enjoyed series 2. I'll be back with another series shortly, but in the meantime, I hope you can find the time to listen to episodes you've missed. And please do reach out and find out more about what I do at www.pierslee.com. That's PIRSLEIGH.com. Take care.